ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant.
In 1776, the American colonies declared their independence from Britain. And July the 4th is the country's birthday. So join me, Nick Bryant, for our America at 250 series. Conversations on how the past continues to animate the present with historians and thinkers such as the legendary documentary maker Ken Burns. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. After the last war, Japan declared itself a pacifist nation and built modest armed forces designed only for self-defence. But the country is now rearming, and there's a problem. It's proving incredibly hard to recruit the men and women they need. There aren't many around, and those that are aren't interested. To Japan later. Also to Mexico, and another smuggling problem, not drugs this time, but succulents, for which there's a market worth a whopping $6 billion a year. Particularly sought after are cacti, harvested in the wild and smuggled into the United States. As a result, many cacti are facing extinction. We meet vigilante conservationists who do what thieves and smugglers do, but they say that they will save the species. Well, we'll see about that later. But first, Bruce Shapiro is with us from his Connecticut hideout to make sense of the United States as it prepares, on the one hand, to celebrate the 250th anniversary of its Constitution, and the other has a Supreme Court that seems hell-bent on wrecking it. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
Very glad to be here, as always.
Bruce, tell us about the sense of celebration in the air. I mean, what will you be doing? I mean, are you kicking up your heels, fireworks, that kind of thing in Connecticut? What's happening?
What celebration? What? No,
at the weekend.
At the weekend, just a few days from now, the country will celebrate the 250th anniversary, not of the Constitution. I have to give you a small fact check, but of the Declaration of Independence.
Bruce, I knew I was wrong as I said it.
the Constitution didn't come around until 1789.
It took a bit of time.
But, you know, this is the occasion on which all of that exceptional generation of founding revolutionaries gathered in Philadelphia declared the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America, the 13 colonies, that began when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, which, of course, I had to memorize when I was in elementary school or something.
And you still remember it.
Here in New Haven, where I live, there will be a standard 4th of July celebration, which is to say about half an hour of fireworks shooting off from the big city park just up the road from my house, for which, sitting in my little office here, I will have an absolutely perfect view. In Washington, D.C., there has already been a 250th birthday cage fight at the White House. The Trump administration is celebrating with a $500 million no-bid contract to build the president's revolutionary ballroom, and there will be fireworks. 450,000 separate rockets and fireworks and explosives setting off around the Capitol. Outside of that, you know, the sense of celebration that sometimes accompanies these anniversaries isn't really very present. After all, this country is as divided as any time in modern times, in modern era, and that very much remains the case.
I watched it from a distance, of course, 1976. The bicentennial, it was huge, and it seemed to be a celebration that caught up the world. This so muted.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is that the bicentennial, which I remember very well, you know, was a truly bipartisan political celebration that had a lot of investment from both parties. Everyone agreed it was a good idea. The country was emerging from two profound crises that had challenged American values, that had challenged its vision of itself. Three crises, really. The civil rights movement, which had, you know, begun a couple of decades earlier and had crested but was still very much in the air. The Vietnam War, the bicentennial in 1976, came after the fall of Saigon, 1975. And most profoundly, given the sort of constitutional stakes, Watergate and the resignation of Richard Nixon. And in that post-Watergate period, there was a lot of emphasis on the values of the Declaration of Independence, that promise, unfulfilled promise of equality, that all men and women, by extension, are created equal. The idea of inalienable rights was very much in the air. The idea of reigning in executive power, of pushing back against the imperial presidency, when the president says it, that makes it legal, is what Richard Nixon had said, right? Mm-hmm. And that, in following Nixon's resignation, was explicitly rejected by Congress with post-Watergate campaign finance reforms and the Freedom of Information Act and other kinds of laws. And we were entering a period of cultural reform that would actually culminate with, you know, the election of Jimmy Carter later that fall. So while the country was emerging from a divisive, divided, in many ways corrupting and certainly violent period, and those questions were unresolved in a lot of ways, it was a period in which people were looking to feel better about the country and in which there was actually a positive reform going on. This 250th anniversary feels rather different, right? We are, in fact, of course, in the middle of a war that we can't seem to get out of, even though we want to get out of it, even though there was no good reason to get into it, politically speaking, in Iran. We are consolidating vast amounts of wealth and power upwards. The country is even more divided than it has been over the Trump presidency, over immigration and migration, over gender and sexuality. We have a president who is pushing all that division. So it's a little bit hard to feel a sense of joint, bipartisan, forward-looking celebration when one of the three branches of government, the presidency, is pushing the very kinds of divisions that undermine a sense of shared vision, shared values, shared aspirations, no matter how imperfect, embodied in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the Constitution and Bill of Rights and the long struggle to bring that Constitution into harmony with it, with the values of the Declaration, actually.
And another branch of the government, the Supreme Court, is celebrating the 250th by consolidating to a remarkable extent the power of the president at the expense of the Congress. Doesn't feel like fireworks and choirs.
There was some interesting fireworks on the court when the Chief Justice John Roberts read yesterday's decision in Slaughter is the name of the case, appropriately enough, Trump v. Slaughter, and the dissent read by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, representing the court's three Democratic-appointed liberal justices, warned of chaos and undermining of constitutional values and so on. It's very, you know, of the many cases that the Trump era Supreme Court has handed down, and not all of them favorable to Trump, some of them not, and I think we're not done. I think we're not done with that. We'll have some more pushback against the president in some ways today if the court, as expected, rejects the president's birthright citizenship order. But this decision yesterday, which to an Australian listener may sound technical, it's about does the president have the authority to fire members of independent federal regulatory commissions like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Federal Communications Commission that are set up by Congress? Can the president appoint their own members of those regulatory commissions? That sounds technical. It actually goes very much to the heart of what the Declaration of Independence was all about back in 1976. That Declaration of Independence was about a king who had arbitrarily imposed fiscal policy and warrantless searches of homes and persecution of printers for free speech and suppression of speech and other abuses of authority. That was what propelled the Declaration of Independence forward. In Trump v. Slaughter, the supermajority, the conservative supermajority on the court, took 250 years of balancing of executive, legislative, and court powers and radically rebalanced it. Said that when Congress sets up independent commissions with leadership that's designed to cross presidential administrations to avoid the politics, that doesn't matter. The president has total control over the executive branch, can appoint whoever she or he wants. And this is a baseline reconfiguration of power in American terms. It turns the entire federal regulatory apparatus into a giant patronage show and turns on its head 100 years of regulatory policy that successive Congresses with both parties in charge have voted for. This is not, we should say, something that was originally Trump's idea. This is the culmination of a campaign that began in the 1980s, under the Reagan administration, when young, ambitious, conservative lawyers and jurists, some of them veterans of the Nixon administration, looked at those Watergate reforms, looked at campaign finance reform and the Freedom of Information Act and all kinds of other constraints on and the War Powers Act passed in 1970, all these constraints on presidential power, and said, what can we do about this? How can we get power, not only get short-term political power back into the presidency, but how can we really ensure not that once a conservative government is elected, it's going to be able to really do its job and do what we want? Yeah. And so people like Dick Cheney, who had been a White House aide in the Ford White House and the Nixon White House, people like Donald Rumsfeld, then a young congressional aide, and then a succession of young, ambitious Reagan Justice Department lawyers pursued a new theory of the Constitution, which at that time seemed very fringe, very marginal, something that they called the unitary executive theory, the idea that the presidency, the lodging of executive power in the presidency means that absolutely everything the executive branch does is immune from congressional regulation. The president gets to hire and fire everybody at will. No. Right? This was a fringe theory. And yet over the years, through the Reagan administration, through two Bush administrations, through two Trump administrations, as one justice after another on the Supreme Court has been replaced by conservative loyalists, by Federalist Society loyalists, this theory has now taken over the Supreme Court.
But Bruce, can I just intervene here for a moment? Because
sorry, you got me on a rant.
No. I call it an aria, not a rant. And yes, that was the theory they used. But I was very impressed by a commentary in the New York Times today that said that the purpose of the Supreme Court in allowing the president to clean out these hitherto independent regulatory bodies is that they got up the nose of business. The problem with these bodies has been a curtailment, yes, of presidential power, but the other point was that they kept doing things to business that business didn't like, and business couldn't bring to bear political pressure to stop it. Now business will be able to, and business at the same time actually doesn't want the president to be able to interfere with the Fed, because the business knows that you've got to be able to keep the economy on a sort of at arm's length from politics. So you have this completely contradictory situation where the president can strip regulatory bodies but not the Fed. Does that make sense to you?
Well, whether it makes sense to me is irrelevant here. But look, big business have been trying to strip the federal regulatory state since it was created during the Great Depression, since it was created during the New Deal. So business interests are certainly one of the powerful currents driving Trump v. Slaughter and driving the kind of economic libertarianism is one of the forces driving this Supreme Court decision yesterday. I actually push back a little bit against it being the only or primary engine. I think you actually have also in Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Samuel Alito, genuine advocates of unbridled executive power to punish people, to go to war, people who are sort of executive libertarians. It's not just about money. It is also about other kinds of concentration of power upwards. That said, it was really striking that in this decision and in another parallel decision yesterday, the court did carve out this big honking exception for the Federal Reserve and said, well, yeah, the president can fire all these regulatory agencies, but not governors of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
That one is too, the economy is too important, we don't want to cause shocks to the world economy.
Yes.
That does show the extent to which business interests and economic interests are a huge part of this court's reasoning.
Alas.
Whether it makes sense and whether in an era of climate change, for instance, the governance of the Fed is really more important than the equally important regulation of the environment and the prevention of the planet burning up by global warming, which, by the way, is about to impose an extreme heat dome on the eastern United States over the next few days, as extreme as anything that was over France and Europe last week.
We will see.
You know, there's a special, we'll have to see, but there is, the court did recognize this carve out for the Federal Reserve as an independent agency whose confidence is really important to Wall Street, et cetera. Right. So, no, it doesn't make sense except in terms of promotion of business interests.
Right. Alas, we must leave it there. And Bruce, but we should just quickly celebrate the fact that Trump is still on the hook to E. Jean Carroll for $5 million.
And a final little Supreme Court comment yesterday.
Yep.
The Supreme Court did uphold the E. Jean Carroll verdict, refused to consider it. So, yeah.
Will he ever sign the check?
Still owes.
Will he ever sign the check?
Supreme Court says he has to. I'm sure he'll find a way to go back to court and delay it further.
Bruce, thank you. I've been speaking to Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor for The Nation, executive director of the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma. Coming up, Japan, a once mighty military nation, simply can't recruit to their military anymore. Japan doesn't have the young people it once had. Now, this figure is staggering. Since the mid-1990s, the 18 to 26-year-old demographic has fallen 40%, which, amongst other things, many other things, means it's incredibly hard these days for the Japanese to recruit young people to the military. Not only are the young in short supply, those who are around can't be convinced to join up, despite the colourful social media messages and anime campaigns of the Defence Ministry. In 2023, the ministry missed its recruitment goal by more than 50%. The lack of interest has the country's leadership worried. How is Japan going to defend itself? Tom Lee is Associate Professor of Politics at Pomona College in California and is the author of the book Japan's Aging Peace: Pacifism and Militarism in the 21st Century. Tom, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tom, why are there so few babies in Japan?
Yeah, there is a lot of reason why the population is declining, and many of the reasons aren't very different than many places around the world where population has declined. It's the cost of raising children is very expensive. The work-life balance is difficult to maintain, so it's hard for families to make adjustments to make it easier to have more children. And ultimately, it's a math problem. As the population declines, you have fewer people making babies. And then over time, and unless that pattern can reverse, you just produce fewer children every single year, and it's hard to get the population to rise again.
We mask the issue in Australia, of course, by high, well, not particularly high, but immigration. But the Japanese have never done this.
Yeah, that's often used as a possible solution to the demographics crisis. Like Australia, I would say, like in the United States as well, like if you look at multi-generational families, their amount of births has gone down, and immigration does keep the population, especially when it comes to labor, at a good enough level to support the economy and maybe in the military. Japan does not have that. So that affects the population because of various debates in government about letting in more immigrants. But one key point about Japan is immigrants themselves in Japan do not have that many children. It's actually not at replacement level either. So that doesn't actually solve it. And for that, I argue that Japan's a very high-cost country to adjust to. The language acquisition is quite difficult. Salaries are pretty low. And so there's a lot of buy-in necessary for immigrants. And so unless that's the barriers are lower, we can't expect immigrants to actually have a lot of children either.
Mm. It's a monoculture.
Yeah, it's changing in some ways, but compared to Australia, the United States, and many places around the world, I would say that's a more accurate statement than being multicultural.
Mm. Tom, there's a shift in the thinking in Japan about the purpose and the size of its military forces. Why is this happening?
Yeah, if we look at polling data, the primary reason for the general public is that China and North Korea, and really after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that the region is becoming more destabilized and dangerous, right? So that's like one factor, that the public is becoming increasingly aware that Japan needs a more robust military force. The second would be the stigma against security topics has decreased. You know, like following the immediate aftermath of World War II, and really up until the 70s and 80s, there was a pretty strong anti-militarism sentiment because of Japan suffered so much from World War II. People really turned away from it. But with natural disasters in Japan and the Japan Self-Defense Force doing a lot of admirable work, saving people during these disasters, their reputation increased. So I think if you put those two things together, the way people think about the military has shifted towards normalizing it. But that's still very different than people wanting to join the military.
Indeed. And what are the conditions, pay, career opportunities, et cetera, of the Japanese military forces as they are now? Is it an attractive, you know, gateway to a bigger career?
Definitely not. I would say that ultimately, if we think about jobs, and we treat the military like any other job, it has to be more attractive than what's being offered in the general economy. So if you think about, say, in the United States, the way that we can get people to join the military, which is quite dangerous because the United States does go to war quite often is that we offer free college tuition, right? We even offer a quicker pathway to citizenship. And there's a general support in the United States for people that join. There's a level of pride or respect for it. Japan's quite different because the military is like any other civil servant job in many ways. The salary is quite low. Secondly, they don't have the same bonus structure as the United States or many other places. And it's more dangerous. So there's the situation where if people are becoming more aware that the military is necessary because the region has become more dangerous, logically, that also means that's not a great attractive reason to go join because now that's more dangerous. You could just, you know, Japan's still a comfortably safe middle class, you know, country where if you just go to college or you don't even have to go to a four-year college, 2 years of college or high school, you could find a decent job in the economy, enjoy your freedom and enjoy your weekends without the risk of, you know, joining the military and having to deal with China and North Korea, or maybe be sent to help the United States on one of its missions. So it's just not that attractive of a job compared to every other opportunity in the country. It's a prestigious job in the sense that you're helping the country, but, you know, there's no military industrial complex. You know, in the United States, I use those examples since I'm from here, is that you could graduate college, join the military, and after that, you could join a think tank, you could join a defense company. There's opportunities, but in Japan, the Self-Defense Force doesn't have that type of pipeline.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Tom Lee, Associate Professor of Politics at Pomona College, California, about Japan's attempts to recruit for the military. They're having a good deal of trouble. Tom, the new government of Japan, or the new Prime Minister of Japan, seems particularly keen to expand the military forces of the country. Are there definite goals being set here? To what extent is this happening because the United States is pressuring its allies to spend more for themselves?
Yeah, so what she's doing is not anything new. If we look at Japan's efforts to modernize and improve its capabilities since the late Prime Minister Abe. So he was doing it before her, and she's continuing this trend. So Japan has increased its defense spending. This was agreed upon by Prime Minister Kishida, which was two prime ministers ago, and now they spend up to 2% of the defense budget. And so that was an objective since Abe to do that. And how much of it comes from U.S. pressure? I would say quite a bit of it. That has always been a thing when you're an ally with the United States, but especially under President Trump. You know, President Trump has pressured NATO. He has pressured Korea to fork up more to make the alliance more equal in terms of contributions, right? So that's not new. What I would say, though, is the desire to increase spending and improve the forces is one thing, but actually having the human resources to follow through and the dynamic economy and innovation to support, you know, more drones, more AI, more reconnaissance, more, you know, technology is still not there. So the aspirations might be there and the pressure might be there, but the actual resources to do so won't be there if the population continues to decline.
So what are they doing facing this reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are in many ways just doing what they can and hoping for the best, even though the math doesn't math. Right. So they are increasing defense spending. And because the human resources aren't there, so they're shifting where they're spending their resources. So there's two ways to think about it. One is they are putting more investment in trying to increase recruitment. You mentioned earlier about, you know, fancy campaigns. They're also targeting women, hoping that more women would join the self-defense forces. So they're retrofitting barracks and creating more facilities so women can join the self-defense force and have comfortable, you know, infrastructure to support them. And they're also investing in technology. And that comes in many ways, such as joint development projects with Italy and the United Kingdom for next generation fighters. And then in some ways, I wouldn't say it's hedging, but they're also looking for other opportunities. So they're looking towards building more relations with NATO. They're looking at AUKUS, the Australia, you know, United States, UK arrangement, and trying to play a role in that. So they might not be formal alliances, but they're hoping to ride the wave of other more, you know, military sophisticated organizations around the world.
Have you any any idea of what they might be planning to do with AUKUS? A very big issue in this country, of course.
Yeah, so Japan would probably love to join AUKUS, you know, and make it a JAUKUS and be a full-time member. But that brings a risk as well. You know, there's this classic abandonment, entrapment position that states are in, right? You want to work closely with allies and like-minded countries so they support you, but you don't want to work so close that all their liabilities become your own. So when you're working very closely with the United States or you're joining organizations that are trying to contain China, that brings on risk as well. So what Japan is doing right now is that they're an associate of the AUKUS, you know, group. And what they're doing is maybe doing joint exercises, doing development of technologies, such as surveillance technologies. And that's what they're at right now. And AUKUS is still quite a new, I would say, underdeveloped arrangement. And that thing's growing as well. So I think the pace right now is quite good for all players involved. They're still figuring things out.
But doesn't Japan have a submarine industry of its own? I think we were going to buy Japanese subs at one stage.
Yes, they do. And it's one of the more sophisticated navies in the world, especially their submarines. So that would be an attractive asset. And for Japan, they would love to be able to sell them. That's why they actually created ATLA, which was their weapons development, you know, entity in their Ministry of Defense a few years ago to improve their ability to sell weapons abroad, right? And this was, I would say, the most meaningful change. Going back to your question earlier about what has changed in Japan is they had a pretty strict arms weapons export ban on the country. And that has been loosened in order for Japan to, it's not really about profiting off the arms industry. It's just not big enough or sophisticated enough to do that, but it's really to do joint development and build better relations with other states to build better, you know, purchasing power for Japan and also to learn from other states that have defense capabilities. Now, Japan's ability to supply Australia and many places around the world will be difficult because their defense industry is underdeveloped. They can only produce so many submarines every year, and it takes a long time to do so. So even though the threats and the population crisis is immediate, the ability to catch up to those problems is still a decades-long process, right? They're not going to be able to produce these submarines for Australia or anyone else within a year or two.
What's Japan going to do about its constitution? I mean, there in Article 9 of the post-war constitution, Japan officially and forever renounces war. Is that going to have to be changed?
I say it doesn't for what they're doing right now. And they might want to keep it that way because it's the constitution has always been a convenient shield for them from American pressure or pressure from internally to be more adventurous in international relations when it comes to conflict. And so, for instance, if we read the Constitution very directly, they shouldn't even have a self-defense force, right? They shouldn't have a sophisticated Navy where they can actually have these powerful submarines, if you read it directly. But it's always been accepted, even by former colonial victims of Japan, China and Korea, for example, that, you know, every country has a right to self-defense. So they even they don't hold Japan to a strict reading of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Now, if Japan wants to put troops abroad or do more warlike and less, you know, internally defensive type of actions, then they might need to amend the Constitution just so it looks consistent. But, you know, Japan has the oldest unamended Constitution in the world. It requires 2/3 of their version of Congress, their diet, and then a majority of the public to vote for it. So they've never amended it before. So if they try, it'd be very difficult.
What about just renaming their armed forces and admitting with this new attitude that there's more going on here than self-defense?
Yeah, so if they did an amendment, well, it doesn't matter what the amendment is. It could be for a pay raise for the prime minister. It could be anything.
Yeah.
It still has to follow this high barrier of amending. So I would argue that it doesn't really matter if they amend it or not, because they're already taking these kind of actions. So I spoke with a member in their research institute for the Ministry of Defense a few years ago for my book. And what he said was quite true, was that Japan will take the action and then they'll go back and look for the legal justification later. And they've always been doing that, right? They've had an arms export ban and now that's been loosened. So, you know, just logically speaking, that would violate the Constitution a little bit more than having arms in the first place. And then they found some kind of loophole or reinterpretation. So they've been, you know, agile enough to be able to do what they need to do without fully amending the Constitution. If they amended it, that would make everything more coherent and logical, but that would be a signal to countries around the world, such as China and South Korea, for them to be quite critical of what Japan's doing with its military.
Tom, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to Tom Lee, Associate Professor of Politics at Pomona College in California, and author of this book, Pacifism and Militarism in... I'm sorry, author of a book called Japan's Aging Peace, Pacifism and Militarism in the 21st Century. Coming up, cacti and crooks. The man I live with loves spiky plants that hardly ever flower and seem to need a great deal of time-consuming care. Among them are dozens of cacti that all look the same to me, hostile, but because I trust him in everything, I trust they can be loved. So loved, in fact, that smuggling and land clearing now threaten the survival of hundreds of species of cacti. There are laws and treaties banning smuggling, but trying to enforce those has made the illegal trade bigger than ever. So along come ethical poachers who call themselves vigilante conservationists. Luckily, I've got someone here who can explain what this means, because ethical law-breaking doesn't make much sense to me. So, Charlie McCann, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much, David, for having me. It's great to be here.
Charlie is a feature writer for The Economist's magazine of long-form storytelling, 1843. She joins me from the UK. Now, Charlie, what is a vigilante conservationist?
This is somebody who believes that there are certain circumstances in which the poaching of succulents may be appropriate. So, for instance, if one is on a trekking through the desert and comes across, a population of plants which are under threat, one could harvest one of those plants or take a cutting or take some seeds and take them home with you and propagate them at home and sell them to consumers. And the argument for doing that would be to ease the pressure on the wild population of these plants by selling them commercially.
But what's the difference between that and any other criminal smuggler?
Well, that's a good question, David. And I think the proponents of this approach to conservation would say, look, the real bad guys are, they are a risk of wiping out entire species with their, rapacious approach to this thing. There are instances of entire species of succulents being wiped out from over-harvesting. What these people are doing is taking just, a cutting. They're taking a few seeds, which doesn't harm the plant, and they're taking this material home, and thereby they would argue saving the species from extinction.
We'll get into more detail on this in a moment. But Charlie, from your article in 1843, I was astonished by the size of the market for succulents. Now, we're talking about more than cacti here, but the size of the market each year is huge.
That's right. Yeah. One market report estimates that it was worth $6 billion a couple of years ago, and it's projected to grow and grow. They have always been popular, but they've really, there's been a boom in popularity in over the last decade or so. They're easy to care for. They're very photogenic. They come in all these different, wild, different colors and shapes. They have this kind of beautiful tactility to them. And so they look good on social media. And when the pandemic happened, people were stuck at home. They wanted to do something with their hands. And succulents, for many people, were the answer.
Charlie, beautifully tactile. They're covered in spikes.
Well, some are. The cacti are, for sure. The cacti are a type of succulent, and there are many different kinds of succulents. So yes, be careful around cacti for sure. But then other types of succulents have these, you know, they don't have the spines, and they have these marvelously fleshy leaves that just beg to be touched. I always want to touch them. So that's part of the appeal of these plants. It's just the enormous range within them.
And the flowers, when they come, are spectacular.
That is true. And that's people who are into cacti often talk about the flowers, because you have the sort of almost kind of masculine bristliness of the spines, this kind of armor that they have. And then, you know, maybe once a year, once every 2 years, for just a few days, they erupt in the most astonishing flowers. And that contrast is just so astonishing.
I can't tell you the happiness in my household once every 2 or 3 years when one of these flowers pops out. They last, some of them, only for about 4 hours, and then they die off again. Yes.
Right.
Extraordinary. Now. But I don't want to inflict my troubles on you or indeed the listeners to Late Night Live, but you decided to join one of these vigilante conservationists.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Vigilante conservationists and drive undercover into Mexico. What happened?
We were on the hunt for a particularly fine example of a kind of agave. So with regular agaves, the leaves are edged with these spines. And on this particular specimen, the spines had fused, kind of creating this sort of ragged fringe, which, you know, it looked as if it had been dipped in sort of purple and pink paint. And the crew that I were with were totally smitten by this plant. They'd seen it once before, and they wanted to find it again. And so I went on this kind of expedition with them into Mexico from Southern California, and we found the plant. They took what's known as an offset, which is a sort of a baby plant, basically, and they didn't have, you know, the necessary permits to do any of this, but they said it was, you know, the right thing to do in their view, because the plant was likely going to be destroyed, whether because of, you know, farmers clearing the land or because, you know, unscrupulous poachers might take it. One of the guys I was with told me that this plant's picture was all over the internet. It was a big deal. People were so into this plant and poachers were likely to come for it.
The picture of that particular plant was all over the internet.
Yeah, that particular plant, because of what they described as this mutation that meant that its spines looked super cool, basically.
So they were protecting the plant by taking a bit of it.
Precisely.
Right. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Charlie McCann about the cactus trade. So now, you were keeping your eye out at all times, I suppose, for police, troopers, any other kind of law-abiding authority. And you got away with this completely. No trouble smuggling it back into California?
Yeah, that's right. As we crossed the border, the agents, you know, took a look at what we had in the back, but it was a kind of cursory examination. And so they sent us on our way, and yeah, we got away with it.
Tell me, where had you hidden the sample of this plant? Now, come on, this
that
is Australia.
Telling, David.
No, I can't possibly say.
But we didn't. It's not like we hid it within the cushions of the car and the tire or the undercarriage, or whatever. It was just in our bags.
Right. And so these, I keep calling them samples. That's not the right word, is it? It's cuttings or.
Cuttings.
So these cuttings were then taken back to somewhere and grown and sold.
Yes, ultimately that is the plan. I mean, it takes a long time to propagate agaves, and so they will ultimately be sold. And again, like that is the hope is that by selling these plants, it will deter. It will deter people from going into Mexico itself and harvesting the entire plant itself.
Yeah, by supplying the market in this way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, you also write that there are all sorts of attempts by sort of garden clubs and garden organizations to crack down on exactly this, not just smuggling, but gathering in the wild at all. Now, what's this about? That seems to be quite extreme.
Yeah, there is a big push on the part of succulent clubs in the US and in Europe as well. They recognize that there is this real crisis afflicting the plants that they love so much. The overcollection plays a big role in that crisis. And part of the problem, David, is that there is this real appreciation within the succulent community for the aesthetic of wild grown plants. They like plants that grow in the wild look quite different from those grown in cultivation. They're just exposed to the harshness of the environment they grow in, right? And so they often look kind of quite like weathered, wizened, shriveled. They have much more exotic colors kind of coursing through the leaves, red, orange, purple. They look radically different. And because these plants are harder to get a hold of than the ones in cultivation, they're that much more exclusive, that much more rare, and for that reason, much more prized. And so that incentivizes people to just go, pick them up from the wild and take them home. And the clubs are now encouraging their members, instead of doing that, what you should do is just grow them from seed. But it's a big shift within the community and very controversial.
Wouldn't another approach be for organized, careful harvesting of succulents in the wild, not by individual troops like you went with those three guys who sound fantastic, but do it officially, do it carefully, and conserve the stock?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea. The problem is that the countries that these plants naturally occur in, they have conservation programs, but they're often just not resourced enough to be able to engage in those sorts of approaches.
Yeah.
And they're up against organized crime. I mean, Mexican cartels are widely thought to be involved in the illegal succulent trade.
As well as drugs.
They've diversified. And so that's who they're up against. And it's really not a fair contest.
Have there been any attempts by the Mexican government to actually crack down on both the harvesting and the smuggling?
Not that I'm aware of. It's one of those things where the laws that they have regulating the trade in these plants are incredibly harsh. I mean, it is so difficult to get a permit to export many different species of succulent that they have an effect. Oh, sorry, I should say it is so difficult to get a permit to export any cacti from Mexico that they have effectively banned the export of these plants. But there's a lot of crime in Mexico, only so many resources to go around. And so Mexican law enforcement really, has its focus on other priorities.
Indeed.
The thing that really intrigued me about this story, I suppose. So I was curious about how, you know, how could you justify poaching in the name of conservation?
Yes.
And it's kind of the hobby attracts real obsessives. And I was curious about how they rationalized this kind of behavior to themselves. Were they doing it for the reasons that they said they were? Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. And so the thing is, you know, as one academic put it to me, people love these plants to death. And I was just curious about the mindset of the people who are participating in this, you know, who are so driven by their passion for these plants, but the kind of sort of collective impact of this is that, you know, that it's really putting the future of these plants in jeopardy.
Can you see what it is in these people that gives them this passion? And I ask you this question, Charlie, because it might help.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there are the plants themselves, right, which do have these incredibly, this sort of strange, surreal appeal for, you know, many people in the States, you know, have very, very little sort of exposure to these plants. They just are so alien. And so there is that kind of draw from the plants themselves. But I think they also attract a certain type of person. You know, some of the people I spoke with, one of the guys I went on the expedition with, you know, he was a collector, you know.
Yes.
You know, it attracts people who like to, or interested in taxonomy and are kind of completists. You know, they want to catch them all, the famous sort of Pokemon phrase, right?
They want one of everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that that rings a bell. That rings a bell. Charlie, thanks again for joining us on the show. I've been talking to Charlie McCann, who is a feature writer at 1843, The Economist's magazine of long-form storytelling. And her piece was called My Road Trip with the Do-Gooding Cactus Smugglers, Can Poaching Ever Be Ethical? And that's the show. On our next, 30 years ago, the Northern Territory became the first state in the world to offer medical assistance to those wanting to die. The legislation lasted long enough to inspire the film Last Cab to Darwin, but it was shot down swiftly by the Howard government. We talk to its author, the former Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, Marshall Perrin.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.